Morning, listeners, and welcome to this week's News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by CARMA, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. CARMA is a peer-based community-controlled drug user organisation. The community of people who inject drugs were very instrumental in responding to the HIV epidemic back in the 1980s in Australia, and they remain active in disseminating information into their community about bloodborne viruses and many other harms. Many human rights abuses resulting from the current war on drugs, a war on people who use drugs, continues. We'd like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the legacy of the peers who went before us and reaffirm our commitment to fighting the effects of stigma and criminalisation in all its manifestations. The show aims to inform and educate listeners about the failure of the war on people who use drugs, and we also promote services offered by CARMA and also other agencies in the sector. And on that note, it's my great pleasure to welcome our special guest, Christine Magner, who is the Interim General Manager of the...
Good morning.
Oh, sorry, Mary. Good morning to you.
Good morning, everybody. And sorry, back to Glenda, who was in a hurry.
Sorry, Glenda... Christine was the person you... Sorry, right. I'm totally
Glenda
confused.
Glenda Stevens, from Interim General Manager from DVCS.
Well, good morning, Glenda, and apologies
Jeff
for that.
Good morning, Jeff and Marion.
How are you?
Good
morning. Well, obviously, a tad anxious. Press for time will always get us a little bit wound up, but it's good to have you here with us.
And I'm really pleased to be here talking to you.
Look, thank we really you. Appreciate having you here. Glenda, it's part of the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, which... we've a part of, and it's a global campaign, which is very important. It's a global issue.
And CARMA's part is actually specifically against women drug users. So we actually work to inform, educate and protect women who currently use, or may or may not currently use drugs. So that's the important focus for us, Glenn, may well be. People who may or may not currently use drugs, women especially. Sorry, Jeffrey, to interrupt.
But given you've only got 20 minutes and you've got other time pressures, I thought perhaps the first obvious question is to tell listeners about what your service is and some of these things that are done.
Okay, Jeff. Well, DVCS, most people in the ACT have heard about the Domestic Violence Crisis Service. So we're a not-for-profit organisation, so we're not part of government, we're a not-for-profit. And we've been here in Canberra for just over 30 years now. And we offer a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week telephone crisis counselling service. And it is open for anybody in the ACT or, you know, those little environments around us, you know, Yass, Goulburn, etc. You can ring in and you don't pay for it. We don't screen people. It's anybody who's experiencing or thinks they may be experiencing some elements of domestic violence. And, of course, that's not just physical violence. It's all the elements of domestic violence, whether it's coercive behaviour or financial abuse, etc.
Or watching people's phones? Like
yes, technology.
We've had some advertisements, haven't we?
That's a really big, growing area because it's something that's... insidious, somebody monitoring your behaviours and where you might be and then taking you to task on why were you here when you said you were
who
there.
Who were you talking
that's a,
to?
That's a controlling behaviour and is. That's a form of domestic violence. But as well as the crisis service, which if any of us were to ring them now or tonight, would talk to you and ask you, first of all, are you safe? Do you feel as though you're in a safe space right now? If the answer is yes, talk to you about what it is that you need in by way of support right now. Do you need to be able to, do you need to relocate to some emergency accommodation? Do you need someone to come out and visit you? Do you need to put in some plans to get you through the night? That's the first question. And then we talk to you about, well, what's the next step? What's the next step that you want? So we're not imposing our rules on you. We're saying, what is it that we can do to help you move so you and your family can be in a safe space to be able to move forward in your lives? So whether so that's our first, that's our primary, our core business, as we call it. And then if for some reason you end up in the court system, we have a program, a court advocacy and program, which helps women again while they're at the courts, because it's such a big system and it can be quite overwhelming.
Especially the court system, which is a performance.
Yes.
And if you don't know how to perform, you don't know how to behave at court.
But and also talking you through the process and what will happen next.
Absolutely.
How this has happened and when things are coming up for hearing. So we're helping women and sometimes men through that through living through that process. And then we have some support programs as well. So staying at home, if the family wishes to stay in the home. We also work with young people because we know that witnessing violence can lead to a lifelong cycle of violence in the person themselves. So working with young people to understand what it is they've witnessed and how to unpack it and move forward with their lives. And we also run support groups for children and men, children and women, which gives education and builds independence and confidence. The other program we run is also for men who use violence and want to stop that behaviour.
Okay.
And part of that is also talking with their partners or former partners, etc. But that's a really important part of our work as well.
Yeah, well, so, without their participation or learning or education or thinking about what they're doing, they're not going to change.
Because in lots of relationships, the pair wants to stay together.
Yes.
They just want the violence to stop.
Yeah.
Yes. So that's a program that helps that occur. So we work from education, also educating people about what is domestic violence. We do a lot of work in the government with their staff, whether it be with health or child youth protection or the police, to get them to understand more about domestic and family violence as well.
Do you think we've come a significant way from the old days in terms of police understanding? You know, in the old days they'd say just the domestic and not actually take it seriously.
Huge way. And actually at the moment there's a program which is being trialled on some Fridays and Saturday nights about supporting people who are on orders to maintain the validity of their order, and also DVCS is involved in helping the police with that process. So there's a lot of working together of different agencies coming together, ourselves, other not-for-profits, the police, health, the mental health sections of the government. It's actually, there's a lot happening because we do know that domestic and family violence is something that happens across our whole community, and it's something that unless we know it, we identify it, it's going to keep going, and it's such a drain on people, and particularly women and children, just because of the gender imbalance of domestic violence.
And aside from the morality, Glenda, there's the financial and economic cost of lost opportunities for women, the trauma, you know, the cost of dealing with.
Of course, the economic argument is just laid out that we're losing the talents of those women. We're losing sometimes the talents of their children. We're losing them in our community. We're losing them in our workforce. We're losing them as an enriching person. We're losing the people's contribution, but on the other hand, there's a huge impost on our health system, our mental well-being, our policing. Even running organisations like DVCS, you know, we often say, wouldn't it be great if we didn't have a job? Wouldn't it be great? You know, that's, to me, that's the ultimate, to not actually have an organisation like
wouldn't
DVCS.
Wouldn't that be fabulous?
Yeah, it's
to not need to be needed, yes?
Yes.
To not be required.
Yes.
Socially.
It's a bit like with us hoping to see the end of prohibition and do ourselves out of a job.
Yeah. So there
every week we think, wouldn't that be nice if we didn't have to do that? Glenda, in what way does DVCS have an opportunity, or how do you work with women who use drugs?
So
can I just mention for a second, sure. We find women who use drugs are often frightened to use services because they have a feeling that they will be identified as bad parents, and this has happened often, and therefore because of the need to notify, the mandatory notification laws, that they are nervous to get in contact with services because they will be identified as bad mothers and lose their children.
I recognise that, Marion. Mm. I do.
What does that mean?
But what does that mean? In the reality of DVCS's world, what does it mean? If someone was to contact us, the first thing we do is we recognise that often the use of the drugs, whether it's prescription, non-prescription, tobacco, or alcohol, even caffeine, is very often the way the woman is able to deal with her current situation.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. We often see it as a coping mechanism. The next thing is that we want to make sure that if we need to move the woman into, or if the woman chooses or needs emergency accommodation, that she is going to be safe in that emergency accommodation. So they're the first two things that we need to know. We don't need to know lots of details, but we do need to know that you'll be safe, and we recognise that sometimes it's a coping mechanism. If we don't think the person will be safe in our emergency accommodation, we work with them to find other suitable accommodation, okay?
So is that what you're saying, that perhaps by using drugs they're not safe?
What I'm saying is that they may not be safe on their own in an emergency accommodation overnight.
Okay.
Okay? So that's a thing that has to be assessed at the time.
Absolutely. Okay?
Because the safety of the person, and if there's family involved, is paramount. And then the next thing is to talk with them about what it is they want and need. Okay? So as I said, we don't make the decisions. We help people and show them options pathways that they can take if that's the pathway they want to take.
Mm-hmm. What's the area of greatest need? Sorry to interrupt. Sorry. If you have the chance to actually, you know, have your wish list for our political leaders, what's the area that you think would best make an impact?
The best impact would be housing. You know, at the moment we have refuges that are full. We have Tura opening another refuge because there is not enough places for women to go that are safe. And whilst you're living in a refuge, you are able to bring your life together, but it's not until you're actually in your own home that you actually can completely bring your life together and the life of your children. Once you're settled in a house and the children at their school and leading a life that is, I'm going to say regular or normal.
Whatever that means.
Whatever that means
whatever
to you.
Whatever it looks like for you.
Yeah, exactly. But you can't actually move your life forward while you're living in temporary accommodation.
No.
So housing is the key to so many things here. Yeah.
My answer would probably be for you, if I may be so bold as to say, I guess you would try whichever way you can to keep children with their parents, to keep the family intact where appropriate. So children and parent together. If it's singular parent, at least children with parent singular, yes? That kind of safety is priority?
Safety of the children is priority, yes.
Absolutely.
So, and we know children thrive best when they're with their biological parents.
And you can never put families back together the same way once they've been separated,
but
can you?
Families are all... There's no one ideal family. Families are a structure that works best for you. So, and whatever that structure looks like is what you decide and what is the best. And again, we don't impose a judgment upon what your family structure should be.
So it's really about supporting.
It's a supporting for you to reach that decision at that point yourself. And if that is back with the person who uses violence and they've stopped using violence, good. You know, the children are in a home with two parents. But if the children are in two happy homes, that's equally as good.
Mm. Yeah, wouldn't it be lovely? But unfortunately, once the barrier's breached, once it's happened once often, it's difficult for it. Once the barrier's breached, it's breached, isn't it? Once violence has happened, do you find? Or am I making too big a jump?
So what we find is violence, it's... very rarely does it occur once.
Yeah.
It's something that it's... And it's a pattern until a person chooses to stop using violence.
Yeah.
And not that a person necessarily chooses to use it. It could be a subliminal choice, but it's still that they still have to work to choose to stop using the violence.
Yeah.
And everyone working together to support that choice.
I think we need a national campaign to actually address the systemic causes, you know, whether it's patriarchy or sexist attitude towards women or lack of equal pay. You know what I mean? Feminised industries. Australia has a problem with sexism, in my opinion, and it needs a national and buy-in from all, not just one party, all parties, you know. Like the Liberal Party talked about having
a
woman
nice
problem.
Wouldn't it be right across the board?
Well, we need
had a unit, like a universal... in terms of politically universal approach to domestic violence, to or home-based violence.
We have a national plan for domestic violence.
I know, we've got a national plan for hepatitis
Yes, we do have lots of national plans. And but when we come to gender-based violence and gender inequality, it's something, I think the first thing is to recognise it's there. And no matter how much we want to say it's not there, it is there. And we've learnt that during the COVID, where the COVID phase, where most families, or many families, I should say not most, many families, were all at home together. There's and the kids, mum, dad.
Yes.
And so what we found was dad got the spare room and set it up as his study and the computer his, and that.
Yep.
Mum got the kitchen bench and was supervising the schooling and making the lunches and doing her Zoom meetings cooking, with the TV in the background. You know, and on the surface, that just went, well, that's how it is. Well, actually, no, that's gender-based.
Yes.
That's a gender-based decision.
How come he gets an office and she gets a kitchen bench?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And it's so, and so we need to all of us think about that. Every time something happens in our own household, think, oh, we made that decision because of gender. And because it really is quite often ingrained in us. Mm. So starting to think, and starting with our young ones, and I often tell this little story about when my daughter was young, a friend was married to a pilot, and the mother of this a little girl said, oh, when Alexandra grows up, I hope she marries a pilot. And I said, no, when Alexandra grows up, you hope that she
is a pilot.
Yeah.
And she went, yes, you're right. So it starts, you know, like it starts that young with little children saying
it is.
Yes. You can do, and we're getting there. We've got STEM programs happening where we're helping young girls. We know that girls withdraw from science and technology subjects when they're in year three.
Glenda, I thought mine was given two boys for just that reason, was so that it was my job to train them to be good men.
Yes.
Don't you think? I mean, I just felt that that was my job, Jeffrey, that the reason I had boys, and I wanted a girl desperately, no, reason I had boys was so I could train them. And they are, they're good men.
Good.
You can train them. It is an educational thing.
And it takes time.
It does.
It does take, because we're asking people to question their thinking and then perhaps adjust their thinking.
Yes.
And
perhaps change it completely.
The most more patriarchal you are, the harder that is, because you know, your masculine behaviours are very ingrained, and you very much want to, you know, be always right and the dominant one in a relationship. So that makes it even harder.
And but women who question that are often seen as challenging, rather than questioning. You're challenging me, they'll be told. Stop challenging me.
It's the use of
language. It's not right, is it? Oh, yes, important, down to the core.
And we hear it in politics. Oh, she's a very aggressive politician. And but if it's a man, he's assertive.
No, no, no. She is. She's what is she? They call her? She's a very hard-headed woman. Or she's, you know, there are words to describe.
And that's gender-based language, isn't it?
Slut-shaming so many times. And so many women will say, I've never been subject to domestic violence. And then you ask them questions that might get them in some of the ways that you've said and some of the ways we've discussed. And you'll say, they'll find out, that, oh, yes, there has been violence, or there has been...
There could be elements.
Yes, there has been a structure in my family where I have to put myself second or third or fourth or fifth. And I do have 15 jobs, not one.
And, you know, sometimes we do choose to put ourselves second because or third or, you know, whatever. But that choice comes from a position of equal power. And that's the difference. So when you make a choice or a decision as an equal...
It's very different
to when you make a choice or decision out of fear of violence or fear of retribution.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
absolutely.
And that's the power imbalance.
Yeah.
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 Is there something that you haven't said? I know that I've just chopped in on some of your time, Glenda. What have you not said that you need to say that I haven't let haven't let you say?
I think that if anybody is experiencing violence, whether you're using substances or not, you are entitled to have a life free of fear and a free of violence. And you are more than welcome. We encourage you. Ring DVCS's Crisis Line.
I was going to say, do you have a telephone number you want?
We do. And, you know, I always have to look it up.
That's all right.
Yeah, we have trouble remembering ours.
We still do.
It's 2680-0900.
Okay, do that again.
Okay, 2680-0900.
24/7.
24/7 crisis line. But it's also you can ring and ask for information and for conversation.
So that's a landline.
It's a landline. Okay. Yes. Because as I said, a lot of people are experiencing different sorts of domestic violence, and they just don't know it. What they do know is there's fear in their life, and there's things happening in their world that they don't want to happen, but they don't know how to move out of that world or have to have it stop. And so that's what we're really good at, helping you put your life into a position where you're able to be free of violence and live a full and well, healthy life, and give that to your children as
just
well.
Just one quick follow-up question, sure. On just thinking about what you said there. Are there like other ethnic communities that have an extra dimension of negative attitude towards the place of women, do you find? Or is that just being generalisation on my part?
Look, there are the more some communities are more patriarchal, yeah. And therefore there is a harder ask for women. Often
to leave
communities
home,
want to
mean,
keep the,
or to identify their violence.
To identify it, because that's their societal norm.
Yes. Yeah.
And often when families move to Australia and they see that there's a different societal norm, and particularly with offspring, children,
yes,
particularly
yes.
teenage girls, yeah. they're caught between these two worlds.
The difference between management of boys and girls, what they're allowed to have, what the boys are allowed to have. I saw it on a bus. There was a boy who said to his siblings, no, you go and sit over there. I'm sitting in these four seats. Yeah. You go and sit over there together. I'm having these four seats. Yeah. And I turned around and said to him, you can't do that here. This is Australia. And he said, and he looked at me shocked. He was shocked. And his family was shocked because his father wasn't there. But yes, he was horrified.
Norms.
Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. So the answer to your question is some communities, and it is harder for women because if in those communities, often there's language barriers,
yes.
often there's visa issues or concerns.
Fears indeed about visa would be big, wouldn't it?
And fears about being shunned by the community.
Yes.
And losing their network and support, their children being ostracised. So there's an extra element
For some it's a huge decision. Bigger than for
any
maybe.
Woman, it's a huge decision.
Always.
So women can take it as given that it's a confidential service.
Oh, very much so. Very much confidential, yes.
Which is really important.
Yes, and we have a lot of staff who speak many languages.
Good.
And if one of our staff doesn't speak the language that you need, we can get an interpreter.
Fantastic. That's a really important aspect, yeah.
I know we've taken more time than you said you had to give us. Anything you need to say? Or I'm not trying to wrap you up because I would like to ask you way more.
it's just great to know you're there.
I just knew that I'm facing the clock and I knew you didn't have much time.
Thank you.
Through that window.
I can't see that far. But there are several gender sensitive organisations. And if for some reason you go, I don't want to ring the domestic violence crisis line, but I want to talk to somebody, that there's the Women's Health Matters, Women's Legal Centre, YWCA, Relationships Australia, which has got the ACT, Goulburn, or Southern New South Wales region, something similar to that. And even the ACT government's Women's Plan, if you Google that, and you can drill down into lots and lots of other organisations that have women-specific areas that recognising that there's a gender inequality and we're on a journey to try and rectify that. But at the moment, we need extra services and extra attention to rectify.
And if there's money available, put it into housing.
Absolutely.
Very much
and
so.
Refuges and
refuges. Yes.
Because women, you're right, if you haven't got a roof over your head and feel safe, the rest of it is almost impossible.
It can't achieve it,
Yes.
Well, thank you very much for coming in, Glenda. Really appreciate you giving us some of your time. Part of our 16 Days of Activism campaign.
Thank you, and all the best with your 16 days.
Well, yes, particularly for our organisation and our clients, because we find, and this is, forgive me for this, but I'm just throwing it in at the end of your bit, we find there are many services who do not understand women who use drugs, and that was why that question, that very difficult question, services, trying to work out how they manage women who use drugs, particularly when they are thinking about their need to mandatorily report women or children for being at risk, which is often what it is about, children being at risk of violence or of danger, or being at risk full stop. And our clientele, or our peers, more to the point, because we work with our peers, find that services report on the basis of knowing that they are dealing with a drug user rather than the fact that the child is at risk. And that for us is a very difficult proposition It means that sometimes we find it very hard to refer when this mandatory reporting means that there will be split up. It's happened. So excuse me if I'm being impolite and difficult for you, but it's happened many times. So if, and I'm saying services out there, listen to us, because I'm begging Glenda's time, but if you need to learn about managing women who use drugs and how to identify the difference between feeling good and children at risk, that maybe that's what we need to do, is have more conversations about that. Women don't feel safe and don't feel they can keep their children. We've had women whose kids have been taken off them as soon as they've been birthed.
Each case should be dealt with on its merits.
I was going to say the same thing. I can't comment on any of those cases because I don't know the details. What I do know is that the safety of children has to always be paramount. Yes.
Thank you so much, Glenda.
Thank you very much.
Keep up the good work. And thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure, and all the best.
Cheers. We'll go to a song. I've picked Nina Simone's I Put a Spell on You, Nina Simone. Okay, we're back on. This is News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by Karma, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation. And I'd just like to thank Glenda from the Domestic Violence Crisis Service for giving up some of her time.
Who is the interim executive officer at the moment. She'll hopefully be around a bit longer and we can have another talk to her.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I did write down the number of their service.
Yes, it I wrote it down. Oh, here it is, 2680-0900.
Any women that have got issues or have a friend or...
That is their crisis line.
Anyone that, you know, it's confidential. You can get advice as to what services are on offer or possible ideas or get in the violent partner to do some training. I think it's important to have a whole range of options for people.
It was interesting, Geoffrey, that they said, she said they dealt with men too.
Well, I think you have to.
But for men with violence, do you know what I mean? And I hadn't heard that before, because I remember I had a peer that had problems with violence from his partner.
Yeah.
And he was laughed at.
Yeah.
You know, when he tried to report it to the police, the coppers said,
There's also violence in gay relationships, which is difficult to report and leads to a lot of mirth and,
any relationship. And you just think, how could you be like that? That's just...
Well, I think any relationship, like the point you made, once you cross the threshold of violence, it's more than likely going to happen again.
Yeah.
And it just destroys trust and comfort. You know, you need to have someone have your back and have full support. Anyway, look, we'll press on.
Can I do a couple of shout-outs? Yeah. I want to do a shout-out to Kathy and Justin, because I said I would at 11:30, and I'm sorry, but I'm doing it now. I want to do a shout-out to Bethy Simpson and to my niece, Kirsten, because Kate, Beth Simpson's daughter, is writing has written a book for kids about our grandmother who was a nurse in World War One, for teenagers, Geoffrey, which is really exciting. There's probably more, but I'll let Geoffrey do the...
Yeah, look, I'll just do the disclaimer. The contents of this News from the Drug War Front broadcast do not necessarily reflect the views and or the policies of the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy. Karma does not condone nor condemn drug use and does not promote illegal activity. Karma recognises that drug use happens, and as such, Karma focuses on harm reduction messages, drug treatment support services, advocacy and community development. Karma seeks to reduce the harms associated with drug use as well as the harms associated with the criminalisation of drug use through the provision of empowering programs that concentrate on community development, person-centred healthcare and equity of health service delivery of all people. And on the subject of Karma, yesterday we had our first annual general meeting of Karma as an independent incorporated association. It was held at the Havelock House Federation Room, which is a really nice venue. They're in Northbourne Avenue. Went very smoothly.
It was great. I had a terrific time. I don't go to Karma all the time, but I've been there always here for the radio show. And I really had a beautiful lunch. It was a great attendance. And also, the annual general meeting was so exciting because Karma's been around for a very long time, but it hasn't been independently incorporated. So now it has its own management committee, its own financial management organisation, and it has been audited for the first time, Jeffrey, and came out in glowing colours.
Yeah, the auditor seemed very satisfied.
Very exciting,
and
yeah.
There was a good turnout, and I think a lot of people were just very pleased to see the culmination of many years of hard work.
Oh, yeah, and we just have to thank the Interim Management Committee and Chris for the amount of work, and never underestimate the amount of time and energy that goes into incorporation. It is a nightmare, but it was done.
Look, and for any drug use organisation, there's always that extra layer of scrutiny.
Absolutely.
And
look, any NGO, Jeffrey.
Well, that too.
Fundamentally, non-government organisations have a history of fluctuating affection, if you like, fluctuating political affection.
Yeah.
Up and down it goes. Sometimes it's about the behaviour of the organisation, sometimes it's about the political environment.
And a lot of time governments don't like anything that is deemed to be critical of their policies.
Absolutely. And that's what we're inevitably going to be doing as a peer organisation. We will be asking sometimes difficult questions. Well, always difficult questions to be fundamentally, isn't it, Jeffrey? Because we're asking questions about why our drug of choice is illicit.
Well, until prohibition ends, we're going to keep asking those questions,
yeah?
And I think it's not going to change until enough percentage of the general community say enough is enough.
That's
and basically
right.
just pressure,
and
like any social change.
63% of the population approves of the legalisation of most drugs or legal availability or the provision of over 60% approve of a heroin provision program.
The public are way ahead of our political leaders.
They are. They're way. And what have we heard but anti-pill testing again? Not going to happen.
Same old rhetoric.
Of the stuff we've got on today is, same old, same old.
Look, we've got a piece from the Western Advocate about pill testing and support by that's come out of a recent survey, and it says pill testing support continues to rise, but it remains illegal in most of Australia. Pill testing has been a contentious topic amongst politicians for many years, but new research shows almost two-thirds of the Australian population now supports the method that evidence has shown to be an effective drug harm reduction strategy around the world. A new study by the Australian National University researchers has found 63.4% support pill testing, compared with only 21.6% who oppose, marking a nearly 10% increase in support from the 2019 National Drug Strategy Household Survey. The results found there was a correlation between pill testing backers and support for the legalisation of marijuana, as well as marriage equality. And there's a quote, "There is a particularly strong relationship with support for the legalisation of marijuana and to a lesser extent with support for marriage equality. Those who distrust government, who are now a majority of the population, having grown substantially over the last decade, are somewhat more likely to support pill testing. This may be a consequence of young people's experience with politics and aversion to the formal professional politics that is represented by the traditional political parties."
Hmm. Age also played a part in the varying support between societal groups, but it was religion that seemed to have the largest effect. That's interesting. There's a quote. "The results show that strong support for pill testing is based on age, as we would expect, with younger respondents being strongly in favour and older respondents being more likely to be against," the study read. "The most important social background variable is church attendance." That's interesting that they even ask that question, Jeffrey. Yeah? "With those who do not attend church being more likely to support pill testing, while some of the more liberal groups have argued in favour of decriminalisation, such as the Uniting Church, many other denominations are strongly opposed to harm reduction. The ACT is the only jurisdiction to have trialled a pill testing strategy at two Groove and the Move festivals in 2018 and 2019. A pill testing clinic is expected to open in Civic before the end of the year, once regulatory policing and public safety matters are considered. The researchers call for more discussion surrounding further trials to gather evidence for the strategy's effectiveness in harm reduction. Without pill testing trials being considered in most states apart from the ACT, let alone implemented, the researchers suggest it will remain a chicken and egg problem until then." Indeed. The quote goes on, "The objection of the states to pill testing is surprising. since the stated goal of both sides of the debate is to save lives, the study read. The results show that there is a high level of political polarisation surrounding the opinions among both voters and political elites. The issue must be addressed if the policy is to be advanced as part of an overall harm reduction approach to drug use.
Yeah, well, that's positive that two-thirds of the public support pill testing as an effective strategy.
It's interesting that, the Uniting Church has always been a supporter of more radical moral positions, don't you think?
Well, certainly recently they've formalised it in their synod.
Well, they've come more to it, I think, as they have acknowledged diverse sexualities and marriage between same-sex partners, and they've embraced the whole, and the safe injecting clinics, of course, they sponsored those. But, and we've said often that morality has a great part to play in the legitimate argument, for me anyway, the legitimate argument against legalisation. But that's the only argument that I have heard that makes sense, is the moral argument, whether it's okay to be intoxicated or not.
Well, it's definitely still used to justify prohibition.
Constantly, isn't it?
I've got a quick piece from the Pharmaceutical Society of Australia, which represents rank and file pharmacists in Australia. It's their website. And it's entitled, Strong Opioids Have Been Identified as Likely Adulterants in Some Drugs Following Recent Cases of Serious Harm, with those at risk encouraged to access naloxone. New South Wales Health has issued a warning about fentanyl and acetyl fentanyl having recently been identified as likely adulterants in both heroin and cocaine. The warning comes following recent cases of serious harm in Sydney and regional Australia. New South Wales Chief Addiction Medicine Specialist Dr. Tony Gill said a number of people in New South Wales who recently used heroin developed toxicity from acetyl fentanyl and fentanyl. Some described the heroin as being purple in colour. Quote, we've seen a number of people recently where fentanyl was taken unknowingly and was associated with serious harm, Dr. Gill said. Separately to the heroin-related cases, another cluster of fentanyl and acetyl fentanyl has been associated with cocaine use.
Which is not
good. Similar to those seen in October of this year. Fentanyl can cause drowsiness, loss of consciousness and slowed breathing, and when taken unknowingly can be life-threatening. It's important that people realise an overdose can occur with very small doses of fentanyl-related substances. The severity will depend on the amount of fentanyl or acetyl fentanyl within a particular substance and how much people take. If you have taken a substance and are experiencing side effects similar to those from fentanyl, call 000 immediately or seek medical attention. And I actually had a story that Damien mentioned when he was doing the naloxone training for women.
Yes.
He said that some youngsters, students, wanted fentanyl test strips before a party that they were organising.
That's
because they had
idea.
Heard that certain drugs were being contaminated or
cut
or adulterated with fentanyl. So I guess it's taken a while for it to affect Australia generally and Canberra specifically,
so. but
it was inevitable.
There's some coming in now, I think, through the what is it, the dark web and through illicit importation.
New routes due to COVID.
New routes. That's really interesting you mentioned AMO and the training, because Mary and I did the training, training again.
Awesome.
And because we do that regularly so that we can update and make sure that we're not out of date with it. And in fact, we were out of date, so it was really timely. But I asked Emma during that about fentanyl and acetyl fentanyl, because remember we've been told many times about the strength. I keep on saying, so what is the difference in strength between heroin, fentanyl and acetyl fentanyl? And so it's heroin is not as strong as a fentanyl and fentanyl is not as strong as acetyl fentanyl. But the multiplication is like heroin may be, fentanyl may be 100 times stronger than heroin, and acetyl fentanyl, then we're talking about micrograms, not milligrams, which is when we get down to 1,000 times stronger. So when we're talking about adulterating drugs or opioids in particular, cocaine's, that's a surprise for me, but opioids, you're multiplying the dose that you are having sometimes by thousands of times, depending upon how strong or what's in it, fentanyl or acetyl fentanyl.
Yeah.
That was really spooky, Jeffrey, for me. I just thought, wow.
a good reason to have fentanyl on hand.
It's taken a long time to get that info out, though, what it meant, because we were getting it only from the police originally, remember?
Yeah, look, I think...
But it's actually caught up. The information's caught up.
The key thing is to encourage people to be cautious, I think.
And they do have fentanyl strips now that are made available. The needle... not just the needle exchange, the training that we did.
Yes.
Domo had some fentanyl test strips.
Yep.
You can drag them through the spoon to find out if there's any contamination with fentanyl.
Yep.
And so, so they're available, those strips, people, if you want them. You can test the drugs you're using for contamination with fentanyl, which is really handy because we don't know about that. I've never seen any purple heroin, but that may be just for location. But it's interesting to know that that's what it looks like.
Yeah, look, knowledge is safety. And
isn't it, Bart?
Yeah.
And every time you've got to change and get... Keep on learning, people. Keep on learning.
Absolutely.
If you stop learning, you're dead.
As long as it's a black market, you can't be certain what you're getting. Okay, I've got to go to another song. This is Blondie and Call Me Blondie. All right, that was Blondie and Call Me. Okay, it's about 18 minutes after 11. You're listening to News from the Drug War Front, brought to you by Karma, the Canberra Alliance for Harm Minimisation and Advocacy.
It certainly is.
It's time for International Story. And we've got one from Richard Branson.
We've heard from Richard Branson again, Geoffrey. Virgin.com from November the 19th. Now, we know that Richard said pretty much the same stuff, but he says it. That's what matters. And that's what we were just saying off air. He says, while so much of the world's attention is focused on the aftermath of the US presidential election, everybody's going, whew, it is over, really, is it? That last 4 years is really gone. And the transition of power to President-elect Biden, I was excited to see some of the other outcomes of this year's US election. Voters in several states embrace sensible drug policy reforms that will make a huge difference to people's lives. Take the burden off criminal justice systems, improve public health, and ultimately save lives. In Arizona, New Jersey, and Montana, and South Dakota, voters approved a regulated sale of recreational cannabis, continuing a trend that has been going on for several years, bringing the total number of US states allowing recreational cannabis to 15. Next week, UN member states will come together in Vienna for the session of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, CND, the Intergovernmental Forum where discussions on the direction and content of the global drug policy take place. The item on the agenda is a vote. No?
Jumped a page.
I've jumped a page. No wonder Geoffrey is looking oddly at the page.
Page 7.
Ah, that's because...
Under the map of America.
It's on the other side. I wondered about that. Okay, so the people of Oregon went an important step further. That's what comes after recreational cannabis is 15 states in the United States. The people of Oregon went an important step further and supported a ballot initiative to decriminalise the possession of small quantities for personal use of all currently illegal drugs. That's pretty incredible. This followed in the footsteps of Portugal. Oh dear, where decriminalisation in 2001 has led to a dramatic decline in drug-related deaths, as well as infections like HIV and hepatitis C.
I think they're trying to pick the bones out of what did work in Portugal.
I think they are.
Without following
it
completely.
Getting that quoted at us, don't we, Geoffrey, despite the fact that we know that it hasn't really been terrific for drug users. It has had some positive effects, and that's what they're doing.
Well, the PR didn't match up to the reality for drug users in Portugal.
And it's about asking the users, did it work?
Well, that's what matters.
How did it work for you? Yeah. And they didn't do that in a lot of cases until recently, yeah? The news from Oregon shows that voters and policymakers are finally waking up to the grim reality of drug policy, as usual. After nearly six decades of prohibition and relentless decriminalisation of people who use drugs, the failed war on drugs has done absolutely nothing to make a dent in the illegal drug trade. This global business is worth at least $350 billion annual. I reckon it's more than that, Jeffrey.
I think it'd be more too.
Don't but you reckon? I think we should be talking trillions. And we might make an impact on really what it is.
It's hard to quantify, but yeah, that's probably a conservative figure. Yeah.
And but if you don't use those big figures, you know, if you're still talking about people who, countries whose economy is in $1 trillion worth of debt like ours, then if you don't put up the price of the black market of drug use into that same trillion word, it doesn't sound like it's making an impact, does it? Because we've jumped from billion,
it's a big business,
million to billion to trillion.
Yeah.
In within the COVID space, 5 months, yeah?
It's a big business.
And we're happy with it. To make things worse, the arrival of new, more potent drugs like fentanyl have led to new spikes in overdoses and drug-related deaths around the world, showing once more that a hardline stance on drugs that put law enforcement and prosecution over public health is not delivering any substantial results.
And look, as much as I think Richard could be a little bit more strident in his views, he is a global figure. He has been on the commission.
He has got a face.
He's known, and a lot of world leaders respect him as a successful business person.
And if you use the words that they respond to, the phrases, and use the economics and make it readable for them and remain a mate, Jeffrey, he's got to remain a mate. Otherwise, he doesn't get into the meetings where they discuss shit like this,
Okay, Richard goes on to say, for the past 9 years, I've had the privilege of being a member of the Global Commission on Drug Policy, which is a high-level group of former leaders in government, civil society and also business. My fellow commissioners and I have long argued that the only solution to stem the tide is to prioritise harm reduction and promote the decriminalisation and, better yet, the regulated sale of certain, if not all, currently illegal drugs. Next week, United Nations member states will come together in Vienna for a very important session of the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, or CND, the intergovernmental forum where discussions on the direction and the content of global drug policy take place. The item on the next agenda is a vote on rescheduling cannabis. What sounds like a tedious bureaucratic exercise has enormous significance for connecting a damaging historical error. For decades, without any credible scientific basis, cannabis has been scheduled as a substance with negligible medical or therapeutic value that is considered as harmful as heroin or cocaine. After a long overdue scientific review, the World Health Organization has recommended limited rescheduling that at least would recognise cannabis's huge therapeutic potential. A positive vote to remove cannabis from the stricter schedule would at least signal that the international drug control system, traditionally a driver of repressive drug policies, might be able to reflect with the ever-accelerating reforms happening on the ground. I hope the Commission on Narcotic Drugs will come down on the right side of science, public health and history. So it doesn't sound too
Doesn't sound optimistic, really, does it? It sounds like a kind of a cross
wishful.
Your fingers.
Yeah, cross your
fingers. I'm going into the meeting, but I've got my fingers crossed and that's all I can do.
Look, the bureaucracy of the three UN conventions is a massive impediment.
It is.
Makes it very, very difficult to have meaningful reform. And until those international conventions are gone, global policies...
There will always be an argument, won't there?
Well, and countries like Russia and China just want to veto it. They don't even want a conversation.
No matter what we say,
And ironically, you know, the instigator of most of this horrendous global policy, United States, 15 states have got legal
are going against the conventions themselves.
And we're left behind. Yeah. We follow the US on just about everything, but on drug policy, we're...
And it's about the tail wagging the dog in a lot of ways, isn't it, Jeffrey? Do you know what I mean? It's like we followed them into stuff because that's what the tail does. And now we're looking at, you know, that Winston Churchill quote, eventually, you know, the United States will eventually do the right thing after they've tried everything
What's
else.
The quote for Australia?
We'll do it. What? Well, we're behind the United States at the moment. So what does that make us? As I say,
pathetic.
We become the tail.
We're pathetic, let's be honest.
It's very sad.
Okay, let's go to a song. This is the classic by Portishead, Glory Box. All right, that was Portishead and Glory Box from their album Dummy. Okay, it's coming up about 29 minutes to midday. We're into the last third of this week's news from the Drug War Front, brought to you by Karma, on Community Radio 2XX 98.3 FM. Just want to do our usual shout out to anyone who likes listening to news from the Drug War Front or any of the other 60-plus shows that are produced original radio material every week on 2XX, to consider supporting the station as a paid-up financial subscriber. It's an important source of revenue for 2XX, and in fact, all community radio. And, yeah, just seriously consider. It's a sliding scale based on your whether you've got a full-time job or a part-time job or you're on a government benefit. So it's you know, adjusted to people's different income. But it's an important way to support our show and, in fact, all the shows that go to air on Community Radio 2XX, which is the second oldest community radio station in Australia. It's been on the air since 1976, which is quite an amazing achievement. Okay, I've got a couple of short stories on the international scene. This one is smuggling amphetamine under the airport noses, airport authorities' noses. It's an editorial from an Indian paper, the Daily Star, or sorry, Bangladeshi paper, the Daily Star, November the 26th. We cannot allow Dhaka to become a drug trafficking route. In a report published in this daily yesterday, which would have been November the 25th, it was revealed that a group of chemical traders in Chennai had been smuggling amphetamine from India through Dhaka to several destinations, mostly in Australia and Malaysia, after linking up with chemical importers at Mitford Medicine Hub. This smuggling route was operated smoothly by these unscrupulous traders for a year, until 12.5 kilograms of amphetamine powder was seized from the cargo village area of Hazrat Shah Jalal International Airport on September the 9th. It is a huge cause of concern that the banned amphetamine powder, which can be processed into the drug Yaba, can so easily be brought into the country under false declaration and without the knowledge of courier companies. Investigations by the Department of Narcotics Control revealed that at least 600 kilograms of the powder was smuggled out of Bangladesh using courier services after its arrival from India via the border, a trade of 600, whatever the Bangladeshi currency is, I'm not sure what it is, crore or something.
Okay, how is it possible that illegal substances worth such a huge sum of money was trafficked using Bangladesh as a central point of this smuggling route, simply because our airport does not have functioning 3D scanners? While the director of Hazrat Shah Jalal Airport said more CCTV cameras and X-ray machines are being installed at the airport, he was unable to specify whether they were 3D scanners required for detecting drugs, saying only that they are modern. That was in quotes, I might add. Such lacklustre responses will not do. The constant and continuous trafficking of illegal goods through our biggest national airport is hugely damaging to our international reputation and merits a firm and immediate response. We urge the concerned authorities to urgently investigate any airport personnel or employees of the courier service who may have been involved in this smuggling syndicate. The airport authorities must ramp up their security scanning, and the courier services must also play their part in ensuring that such illegal trades do not continue. Drug trafficking syndicates are never easy to dismantle, but there must be serious and concerned efforts from all agencies involved to make our borders less porous when it comes to illegal trade. Was this selected as an advertisement?
It's an editorial from a Bangladeshi paper.
And ultimately, the government needs to follow the money and ensure that finances for these illegal substances are cut off at the source.
I just think it's sort of funny that a country or a major paper from a country is so concerned about not being seen to be incompetent. When in fact it seems like they are.
In fact, it sounds like they may well have thought it right through.
Well, this next one is on a similar theme. Listeners to the show will know we mentioned a $1 billion ketamine bust that was reported in Thailand recently.
Yep.
Well, now Reuters have done an update and they say that Thailand's $1 billion ketamine bust was a misunderstanding, as officials have since failed to find any drugs. And we reported on this 2 weeks ago.
That's lovely.
Thai authorities announced the seizure of what was then believed to be a $1 billion ketamine bust on November the 12th. Thailand's claim to have seized almost $1 billion in contraband ketamine was wrong, and tests have so far not shown up any drugs, the Thai Justice Minister has said on Tuesday. Somsek Thepisin said tests which turned purple in the presence of ketamine hydrochloride reacted the same to trisodium phosphate, a chemical which can be used as a food additive.
And a cleaning agent,
which is all that they have found thus far. Quote, "This was a misunderstanding that our agency must accept," he told reporters. this wasn't a mistake. It's new knowledge. It's new knowledge. I mean, it just shows the sort of the stupidity of the whole.
Well, and people have said, we'll jump first and think later. Yeah? And yet it can come out with a massive international report.
Well, $1 billion of ketamine is a huge.
It's huge, enormous, bust. But it turns into nothing. It's dust, like dust. Yeah.
Yeah, the minister continued. He said testing would continue. Some 66 of 475 bags had been tested as of last Sunday. Thailand's Office of Narcotics Control Board had announced the seizure on November the 12th and said that it pointed to a multinational drug network. In medicine, ketamine is used as an anaesthetic or an antidepressant, but as a recreational drug, it is used to induce dreamy or trance-like sensations and sometimes hallucinations.
It's used as a pre-operative
I think
drug
so, yeah.
too, isn't it? Yeah.
I've heard the state of euphoria or whatever it is as referred to as the K-hole, where you virtually you can't move physically and you're just locked in this dark space. It didn't sound very nice.
Yes, in fact, Yes.
Not something I wish to experience.
I can tell you right now, it's not. There are particular times when you really do not want to feel that way. And I remember at one stage having unknowingly consumed
ketamine.
And I looked at my hands and they were, it was actually frighteningly hallucinatory subject because I didn't know that's what I'd taken.
Ouch.
And yes, very much so. Only lasted for about half an hour, apparently felt like it was about 3 hours. And as I said, I didn't finish. My hands looked like they were huge, knobbled, which they are, but also that they had wart-like things growing off them and they were growing bigger every time I looked at my hands. I had to stop looking at my hands.
Sounds less and less like fun.
You need someone to guide you through a ketamine trip if you're not going to go to sleep, because I think it's designed as a pre-operative to make you into your sleep.
I think it's
big
in the UK, and I've heard that regular users or overusers of ketamine have led to certain bladder problems where they've actually had to have operations.
So getting it out of your system would be very difficult. And it should be quick. As I said, it should only be about half an hour, I understand, depending upon how you consume it, perhaps.
Anyway, rest assured, the $1 billion bust in Thailand is an illusion.
That was a ketamine-induced illusion.
I've got another female performer, one of the greats, Janis Joplin, and I thought I'd play her classic Me and Bobby McGee.
Oh, good on you.
Janis Joplin. Yeah, the voice of the wonderful Janis Joplin and the classic Me and Bobby McGee, which is from her posthumous album Pearl, which I think was probably her bestseller, but sadly she left us at age 27. Yes. Okay, we've got time for one last story. It's actually back to a national story. It's a message from the CEO of Pain Australia, who I think at the time sort of endorsed the federal government's policy change to try and restrict doctors prescribing opioids for pain relief.
Indeed.
And I'm hoping they've had a change of heart in response to backlash.
Yeah, and in fact, before that, had an interview with a woman from Arthritis ACT, and they seemed to be very much in sync with our position in that opiates are used for what they are required for. And if people need pain relief, they need pain relief. There's
absolutely
no two ways about it.
It's a human right, yeah.
So it's very bit surprising to have this. So as we approach the end of the year and the holiday season, there are no signs of slowing here at Pain Australia. On the 12th of November, we held our first meeting of the Parliamentary Friends of Pain Management Group, to host a discussion about medicinal cannabis for chronic pain. As part of this event, we prepared a briefing document for the Parliamentary Friends that outlined our position on medicinal cannabis on behalf of Australians living with chronic pain. Pain Australia believes that all Australians with chronic pain should have access to the best possible treatment options and care as determined together with their clinicians. This may include medicinal cannabis if patients and clinicians believe that it may provide benefit. Many in our community are calling for access to medicinal cannabis, and we hear the frustration growing regarding the barriers to prescribing for chronic pain. For many, the costs are high, and for health professionals, The limited evidence base leads to confusion around where it's appropriate to prescribe. Together, this results in hurdles that patients must jump over in order to gain access. We are calling on the industry to do more to fund larger, high-quality clinical trials, including here in Australia, to provide this evidence base, which is essential to facilitate patient access.
That certainly sounds like a moderation of their more gung-ho...
For their gung-ho, yeah. anti-let's-not-have-it-walk-up-Mount-Ainslie type stuff.
Yeah,
yes.
Which is good to see. Anyway, the CEO continues, throughout November, we've been encouraging consumer discussions and stories on all of our social media channels as part of the hashtag MyPainJourney campaign. While it has been wonderful to see people open up about their experiences and share support with others, the stories that we are hearing are further evidence of the urgent need to improve pain management services and access in Australia. Hear, hear.
Indeed.
Too often, pain is not managed appropriately due to access issues, costs, and a lack of understanding of pain and how to manage it. And that's the crucial point, I think.
It is, isn't it?
There's a lot of just straight-up misunderstanding of, you know, we have opioid receptors in our brains because we've had millennia relationship to opioids.
There is a reason for it. Yeah, there's a reason for every receptor in our brain.
It's evolution.
Absolutely.
It didn't just happen overnight. Pain Australia is now striving to find solutions to these problems through advocacy to government and communication with consumers and health professionals to build the understanding of pain in Australia. Social media campaign run through the month of November has placed a spotlight on consumer stories and discussion as Pain Australia launched our Pain Journey video series. When it comes to chronic pain, particularly deliberations and decisions affecting consumers, they should be at the centre.
Wow.
There is much about pain that we do not understand, and learning from those directly affected by pain is essential to coming up with national solutions that will prove beneficial. There is also value in creating safe spaces for discussion about chronic pain to reduce the stigma and foster a sense of community and support. So jump online and check out the Pain Australia Facebook page to join the discussion.
That sounds like an echo, Geoffrey, doesn't it? I hear the echo of, you know, talk to the people who have pain, talk to the people who use the drugs and find out what they need. And now, that's changed,
that's
hasn't
a change.
It?
That
it's
is a
huge
definite
change.
It's a definite change.
The other thing, Geoffrey, they've got a Parliamentary Friends of Pain Management.
Which is...
That's a pretty potent kind of access to have, isn't it?
I would have thought so.
When you think about it, that'd be at a federal level, I'm guessing.
I would say it would have to be.
So,
Parliamentary friend, yeah.
I wonder how you get on that one. Do you have a parliament and a friend, or do you have a parliamentary friend, or...?
I'm not sure. Perhaps on their Facebook page there might be further information about it, but it certainly seems they're having a reflection. I would imagine they cop some backlash from people who are members of Pain Australia.
And of people who use drugs to relieve their pain, and they use it successfully. And a result of the change in the politics and the provision and the numbers of drugs that you're allowed to pick up at any one time, they have been reduced to grovelling for their pain. The dignity that you lose on having to go and argue with your doctor for pain relief or pain management has been monumental.
Well, lots of stories from the US after the DEA changed prescribing policy.
Lots of stories and personal stories, Geoffrey, and I think that's what she's saying here. Big response to what happened earlier. We maybe need to rethink all this, especially around marijuana and, you know, medicinal cannabis. And all the research that we've seen on cannabis has been, up until recently, 15 years of Food and Drug Administration in the United States, which only produced negative results.
No medical benefit whatsoever.
No medical benefit whatsoever, which is
ludicrous.
Just so 60 years later, we start again.
Yeah.
Well, 40 years later, actually, because they spent 15 years researching it. So
it's really held back the potential.
It has. And it was like... It's like that was the informed research that people paid attention to, because it was the only research that people could pay attention to. So what do? Doctors will only go with research-based stuff, and yet sometimes they won't even go with research, with evidence-based information.
Well, the really sad thing in the US was the pressure that was put on doctors led to many just wiping their hands of even prescribing any pain relief.
Yeah.
because they were scared of losing their license to
and
practice
and
their
many
livelihood.
Did.
Yeah.
Well, the woman Sars that Maxwell, we had over, absolutely.
Who was the inspiration
she
ended up, for
Naloxone. She had four patients that were getting pain management stuff. It was horrible,
yeah.
wasn't it?
It's
such a good woman.
It's really pretty ugly stuff when it comes to the state intruding. You know, well, the whole concept of prohibition is just mind-blowingly insane.
It is, and it's such an emotional thing, such an subjective decision with objective backup, which is just horrible.
And it's just heart-rending to consider the pain, you know, the remembrance ceremony every year, the names are read out of people who have lost their lives to prohibition.
Every year, Jeffrey, we do that, don't we? And it just...
It's just, you know, it wears you down, yeah.
Look, Jeffrey, overnight there were another two women that lost their lives to domestic violence. So we're having daily maybe three women being killed, like in Australia I'm talking about, who lose their lives to their partners or to their ex-partners. We also, on a weekly basis, have at least one death from opioid-related death. Or drugs-related deaths. So people who have been using opioids and have been also using other drugs and either intentionally or accidentally seek to end their own lives because whatever the drugs were doing for them before is not enough. There have been a few, not just overdose deaths, but intentional overdose deaths recently, some accidental deaths of drug users, not overdoses on drugs, but from drugs but their bodies have responded badly because they were in original pain from pain issues that they had and their bodies just gave up. And they're all lumped together. They become, but they're deaths of our peers for whatever reason.
Yeah, look, I think
it's so sad.
Both issues really deserve serious attention and national campaigns and politicians with the courage to actually consider evidence-based policy and something that works, not just more propaganda.
Indeed. And we look at, you know, the Karma 16 Days of Action. And if you have a look on the website, people, you will see that there is a program of action.
Yep.
Natasha would love to hear from you on 62533643. Notice we have a new introduction, Jeffrey. It's a terrific one.
Thought it was time for a bit of an update.
It's a great intro.
Freshen up the intro. Thank you.
Yeah. Did you just rewrite it recently?
Yeah, just freshen it up a little bit. We'd sort of use the same intro.
It sounded wonderful. I was actually, my jaw hit the table because I hadn't heard that one before. It's great. Anyway, so 16 Days of Action, Campaign for Elimination of Violence Against Women Who Use Drugs. And it's Activism Against Gender-Based Violence. It's an annual international campaign that kicked off on November the 25th and it goes until December the 10th when we will have, which is Human Rights Day, and we will have a march from Karma down to Margaret Stimson Court. In between time, there are plenty of things happening at Karma. You can have a look on the line for the program. This afternoon, there is an arts thing.
Yep. Yep. There's stuff every day between now and 10.
And even on the weekends you can do something like
social media,
keeping a diary and social media contact with other women or other people who are involved in the program.
And there's photos. I noticed photos from the Naloxone for Women training.
Yeah, they're fabulous. I've seen you up there knitting too, Jeffrey. Good on you,
well,
my man.
I'm not sure knitting's the word, Maren.
I saw you giving it a go, darling. That's what matters.
Yeah, thanks.
No. Okay, so violence against women and girls is one of the most widespread, persistent, devastating human rights violations in our world today. And women drug users suffer from on an even more intense level.
Absolutely.
Than women who do not use drugs otherwise.
Yep.
We will always impress that upon you every time we talk about violence against women. We need to think about the extent of violence against women who use drugs.
Well, it's gender issues come into dimension, coming to every major social issue, don't they?
And, so why that was what Glenda was saying, wasn't she, at the beginning, is it's not just about one issue. You can't just be single issue oriented because, you know, your knee bone's connected to your hip bone, Jeffrey. Everything is connected to everything else. We need a universal lookout for each other.
I think,
you know, in whatever way you can.
It should be policies that make society healthier, happier, more compassionate.
And kindness. I remember, what was it? Was it Tibet?
Bhutan.
Bhutan that had a happiness
Gross National
index.
Happiness.
Gross National Happiness. What a wonderful idea.
I know. What a great concept.
I love it.
It certainly beats Gross Domestic Product, I reckon.
Oh, which... absolutely. By 1,000,000%.
Yeah.
But imagine trying to measure Australia, particularly over the COVID thing, by Gross National Happiness. Wow.
Look,
and yet
I could guarantee from when you and I were youngsters, the Gross National Happiness in Australia has gone down the gurgler.
Without a doubt, Jeffrey.
Absolutely.
Can't
no
agree
doubt.
With you more on that one, mate.
No matter what you measure it on. You know, it's still
no
a great country,
scale.
But it could have been a paradise and almost was back in the day.
It was. Well, yeah, there was a minute there. Well, not a minute. There was probably,
a few years.
Would say, about 8 years, 10 years when it was just.
But sadly, it's a memory for the likes
it
of you
is,
and I.
It is, but it could also be a future memory.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it can
come again. It can happen again. It's not only a political entity, it's a social one too.
Thank you very much, Marion, and thank you to Glenda again.
Yep.
And we'll leave you with the theme
and
song.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you, Marion.
Bye,
the Stranglers
everyone.
And Golden Brown, and we will be back again next week. Bye
See
for now.
You.
Bye.